let me just get a little bit interactive here. You've practiced putting your hands up earlier already, so let's just try this. If there has ever been a time in your life when you've asked God to do something and he was either inattentive, uncooperative, or late, just stick your hand up in the air. Okay, and keep your hands up. And just have a look around. And there's lots of people without their hands up who are lying. I don't believe it for a second. Okay, you can put your hands down. I could finish the sermon here because you've learned something. You thought it was just you, didn't you? And it's not. And one of the reasons that this is so difficult for us when God is inattentive or uncooperative or late is that it feels like we are the only ones. Isn't that right? And there's a couple of things that make this even worse. One of them is preachers, people like me, because you know we make this all sound so simple, and everybody in church nods their heads and says, "Amen." And then you ask for God, you ask God for something, and it seems like he's inattentive or uncooperative or late. And somebody says to you, "Well, you just need to have more faith." Or you need to pray more, or you need to get rid of the sin in your life that's blocking you from God, or you need to whatever. In other words, the reason that God isn't answering your prayer is really your fault. It's working out for everyone else. God's answering their prayers, but if he's not answering yours, then there must be something wrong with you. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to put everyone to put up their hands, because for all of us, at some point in our lives, God just doesn't respond to our prayers in the way that we want. Now, the other thing that makes this harder, as well as preachers, is the people around us, because life just seems to work out better for some people, doesn't it? You know, they are healthy, they have a job, they have great kids. Their kids are healthy and have great jobs. Life just seems to go well for them. And you think, you know what? They're not even good people. I'm a better people than they are. They don't even go to church. They spend their Sundays having a lie-in and then playing golf. And I'm trying to do the right thing and do it the right way. And frankly, my life isn't going that well. It's infuriating, isn't it? And so that just highlights the times when God is inattentive or uncooperative or late. And then you have Christian friends who make it even worse. They say stupid things like, "Oh, I was in a real hurry the other day. I was in town and I needed to get something from the shop. And I just prayed, 'Lord, give me a parking spot.' And a woman just pulled out right in front of the shop. I couldn't have been any closer." And you think, shut up. I'm praying for something really serious here, and God's answering your prayer about a parking spot. Are you kidding? Just on Friday, I had a phone call from another Borders Baptist Church asking when our Borders prayer event was going to be, the thing on the 17th. And then she asked about how the building project was going. And I explained to her about how there'd been some delays, but lots of work going on in the background, and we were actively fundraising for the next stage, which would be quite an expensive one, but how God would bring the money in his own time. And she told me a story about when she was in another church years ago, and they'd been in the middle of a building project, and they had a critical deadline coming up where they needed a significant chunk of money more than they had, or the builders would just walk away and start another job, and there'd be a huge delay. And so they all prayed about it, and that night the treasurer had a letter from some funders that they had applied to months before, apologizing for the delay and enclosing a check for exactly the right amount of money. And it was a lovely story, and it's a story, frankly, I've heard from lots of other people in different forms, in different situations, again and again. But at this point, God hasn't sent a check for the money we need. And so, frankly, it's just frustrating because it feels like God is being inattentive or uncooperative or late. So what do we do when that happens? Because at worst, it can be really discouraging. Sometimes it makes us want to just step away from our home group or from church, because it feels like God is answering other people's petty little prayers, and yet you've brought something really serious to God and he doesn't want to know. And it gets to the point where our faith gets eroded away and we start thinking, well, if God is silent, then he must be absent. If God isn't answering my prayer, then maybe God isn't there at all. Or even if he is, maybe he's not the sort of God that's ever going to be active in my life. And there goes our faith and our hope and our confidence in God. So what we're going to do for the next 3 weeks is look at three people from the New Testament. Three people you will have heard of and that God knew and loved, and yet they all felt at the stage in their lives that we're going to look at that God was either being inattentive, uncooperative, or late. And the point of this, the point of all these three stories, and the point for us today as we hear them, is not that these three people thought, hey, everything's fine. They were asking God to do some really important things, and the fact that God didn't made these people feel just as frustrated and anxious as we do. But they were able to maintain their faith because they had a glimpse into the fact that actually God is paying attention. He is not being uncooperative, and God is never late. So, the first story, the one we're looking at today, begins with a guy called King Herod. Herod the Great. He was, and in fact, there were several Herods. So, let's just clarify. Herod the Great, and he wasn't called Herod the Great because he was a great guy. It's because he was a great builder. He was anything but a great guy. He was a really nasty piece of work. He was a puppet king installed by the Romans. And as I say, he was an awful guy. He murdered two of his wives. He murdered three of his sons. He murdered one of his mothers-in-law. This was the same Herod that heard that there was something happening in a little town called Bethlehem that potentially was going to cause him some headaches, and so he sent in his troops to murder all the babies in Bethlehem. You remember the guy. Caesar Augustus, who was the Roman emperor at the same time as Herod the Great was in Israel. He said about this guy, it was better to be one of King Herod's swine than to be one of his sons. He was a real piece of work. So when King Herod died, Rome came in and decided to split up Herod's kingdom because it was too much. It gave one person too much power. And so they split his land between three of Herod's sons. The first son was a guy called Herod Archelaus, or Archelaus, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. And he was given Samaria and Judea in the south. And actually that didn't last long because he was useless. He was a rubbish king, and the Romans kicked him out again fairly quickly. Then in the north, Galilee was given to Herod Antipas. And then there was a third son called Herod Philip, who was given a region further to the northwest. Another character in our story is Herod the Great's niece, who went by the name of Herodias. You can see they weren't exactly very imaginative with these names, all linked to Herod. And Herodias married Herod Philip, and they had a daughter called Salome. At last, someone not called Herod. Following this so far? Okay. Important you get that picture in your mind, because this is important background. Now, this is where things start getting a little bit complicated. Because whilst Herod Antipas was visiting his brother Philip, he met Herodias, and they fell in love, had an affair, and so, go ahead, David, and they ran off together. Herodias divorced her husband Philip and married Herod Antipas. And that was a huge scandal, the divorce in the first place, but then marrying her husband's brother, that's it. So Herodias is now queen of Galilee, and they live in this beautiful city that Herod the Great started building and Herod Antipas kept building. And so for them, everything was great until the entrance of the next person in our story. And his name is John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist had a very famous cousin who you probably will have heard of. Anyone know who John the Baptist's cousin was? Jesus. Absolutely. If in doubt, the answer in a church is Jesus. Jesus and John the Baptist were cousins. There we go. And remember, again, that, because that's important to the story. Now, John the Baptist was something of a hero to the common people. And one of the reasons that they loved him was because he wasn't afraid of anybody. He would just tell it how it was. He would say to people straight up whatever was on his mind. And he had this really exciting message about what God was about to do. We were talking about prophets earlier. He was a prophet. He was sent by God to say what God was going to do. And he started baptizing people in the River Jordan as a sign of repentance. That's why he's called John the Baptist, not because he started the Baptist church. He didn't have other cousins called Simon the Methodist and Brian the Presbyterian and so on. That's not what the Baptist thing is about. So how does John fit into our story? Well, because when Herodias moved into the palace with Herod Antipas, that was against Jewish law. Even though none of the Herods were actually Jewish, that was really offensive to the Jewish people. And John the Baptist began to preach in public against the sins of Herodias and Herod, that Herodias had married her husband's brother. Not surprisingly, that didn't go down too well. That's it. Yes, it's been a long day already. So Herodias went into Herod and said, look, we need to get rid of this guy. We need to get him off the streets. And Herod agreed with her. In fact, we know from other historical sources that Herod was afraid that there was going to be an insurrection from the people because of this marriage to Herodias. It had caused such an upset. And so there was John the Baptist stirring all this up. So that is the setup to our story. Better than EastEnders, this. What's going to happen? Well, the details of this are in a couple of different places in the Bible. So let's start in Mark 6. If you've got your Bible, do turn to it. And I'll read this to you. Mark 6, from verse 17. It says this: Herod himself had given orders to have John arrested, and he had him bound and put in prison. He did this because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, whom he had married. For John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Not lawful as against Roman law, it was against Jewish law. That's the point. Not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But she was not able to, because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. So there's an interesting little twist there. Herod is in this bind. He needs to get rid of John, but at the same time, he recognizes that there's something quite special about him. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him. So that's the situation. John the Baptist is in prison, and for John, that must have seemed pretty rough. I mean, being in prison is tough for anyone, but John had been sent by God to announce Jesus, and that's exactly what he'd done. He was baptizing people one day, and Jesus walks along, and John calls out to everyone, hey, everyone, stop for a minute. You know that guy I've been telling you about, the lamb that takes away the sins of the world? There he is. That's him. It's Jesus. And he says to his own followers, guys, thanks for following me. I appreciate it, but you need to stop following me and start following him. That's your man. So he'd announced Jesus. He'd got the people ready for Jesus. He'd preached the truth. He'd done everything that God had told him to do. And now he's in prison. If ever there was a time for a miracle, for God to do something amazing, this was it. And yet John just rotted away in prison day after day. But he was getting news from the outside. People were coming to visit him in prison and telling him all about the extraordinary things that Jesus had been doing. Healing people, doing miracles, casting out demons, raising the dead, all these amazing things that Jesus was doing for complete strangers, even for Romans. And yet Jesus wasn't doing anything for his own cousin John. You can imagine that John just wasn't feeling the love. And not surprisingly, he started to have some doubts about exactly what was going on. So here's what he did. Turn back to Matthew chapter 11. And it says this in verse 2. When John, who was in prison, heard about the deeds of the Messiah, he sent his disciples to ask him, "Are you the one who is to come? Or should we expect someone else?" And I can't help but think his friends must have thought, "Seriously? You want us to ask him that? After all that he's been doing? I mean, John, you were the one that told us about this guy in the first place, and now you want us to ask him if he is really the one?" Now, here's why this is so important. Because what happened to John is exactly what happens to us, which is that when our circumstances take a sudden change, it can have a huge impact on our confidence in God. Somehow God becomes different because our circumstances have changed. And we know up here that doesn't make any sense, but in here it is totally real, isn't it? And quite quickly, no matter how much we know the truth about God, no matter how long we've known him or what we've seen or experienced in the past, suddenly it's not working. And we need a little word, a little reassurance from God that he's still there. So John's friends go and find Jesus, and they give him this rather embarrassing and awkward message from John. But Jesus knows that John's world has shrunk to the size of his prison cell. And he knows that that sort of trauma, that sort of huge change in circumstances can have a profound impact on you. And so this is what Jesus says. In fact, what he doesn't say is, "Yeah, of course I'm the one. Go back and tell John, of course I'm the one." He doesn't say, "Tell John, I'm going to come and break him out tonight. We're going to write on the cell walls, 'Ha, ha, ha, Herod.'" He doesn't say any of that. This is the message he sends back for John. But this is for you and me too, when God doesn't seem to be paying attention to our situation. Here's what he says, verse 4. Jesus replied, "Go back and report to John what you see and hear. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor." John can't see anything or hear anything beyond his prison walls. You need to go back and tell him what you see and what you hear. And then Jesus says, "Guys, one more thing. This is really important. I need you to tell this to John." Verse 6. "Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." Tell him, blessed is anyone who does not stumble or stumble away or fall down or fall away, fall out because of me. Okay, let me get this straight, Jesus. What you're saying is you might actually do things, you might actually allow things that would cause us to stumble away from you. Yeah. So I want you to make sure you tell John, "Blessed is anyone who does not stumble away from me because of something I have or haven't done." Okay? So you know he's in prison, and he's losing his faith, and he's really struggling. You know about that, yeah? And I realize that the reason that that is happening is because of me, because I've left him in there. Okay, so you don't like him? So when you were cousins growing up, he did something nasty to you, and this is like revenge or something? I mean, why in the world would you allow him to lose faith in you because of something you've done? That doesn't make any sense. So is it that you don't like John the Baptist? And Jesus says, no, that's not it. But verse 11, Jesus says, truly I say to you, among those born of women, which is most people, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Jesus is saying, I think he is the greatest guy that has ever lived so far. But you're going to leave him in prison. Yeah. And tell him, keep holding on. Don't lose your faith just because I've chosen not to bail you out of prison. Now, let me tell you why this is great news for you and for me. It means this, that your personal circumstances do not necessarily coincide with how God feels about you. Don't ever lose sight of that, because like John the Baptist, when we're in the dry season, when we're in the desert, when we're in the wilderness, when God hasn't done anything for us lately and things seem to be getting worse and worse, we begin to think, well, my circumstances must reflect the way that God feels about me. And God says, no, they don't. No, they don't. Your personal circumstances do not necessarily coincide with how God feels about you. Don't ever draw that conclusion. Proof of how God feels about you is what happened at the cross. Not what's happening at home now. Not what's happening at work now. Not what's happening in your love life, or what's not happening in your love life, or with your children, or with your health, or anything else. So what do you do when God doesn't seem to be paying attention to what's going on? I think if we were to ask Jesus what to do, I think he would give us the same advice that he gave John in prison. You look back and remember, and you look outside your circumstances and you reflect. You look back and remember, and you look outside your prison walls and reflect on the activity of God. You look back and you remember those times when God did come through for you. Because what's happening now doesn't discount the reality of past answers to prayer. Of that difficult patch you had in your marriage and God came through. Or when you prayed for a child and God came through. When you had a difficult time as a teenager and God revealed himself to you for the first time. And it just radically transformed your life. All those past occurrences. All that past interaction with God, it was real. It was true. And you look outside your current prison and you remember. You remember and you take courage from the fact that God was real then. Now, he's just not expressing his reality in the way that you want him to. You know that this story doesn't end well for John, don't you? You know how this ends. Herod has a birthday party. Salome dances. Herod says, wow, that was fantastic. I'm going to give you anything you ask for, up to half my kingdom. And she goes off to ask her mum what to ask for. And her mum says, tell him you want the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter. And so Herod doesn't want to look bad in front of his guests. He calls his soldiers. They go down to the prison that night and they behead the cousin of Jesus. And it's not too long after that that some very insecure religious leaders pay to have Jesus betrayed and arrested and tried and mocked and lied about and crucified. and God does nothing to stop it. But God didn't move one centimeter off the center of his throne. Because even though it would seem that he was inactive, uninvolved, far away, not paying attention, late, God was right where God wanted to be. And 2,000 years later, we are still talking about it. 2,000 years later, we are still celebrating it. People's lives continue to be transformed by what seemed to be the inactivity and the inattentiveness of God. When God is silent, he is not absent. When God seems inactive, it doesn't mean he's inactive. When God seems to be late, it doesn't mean God is late. It just means that in the midst of those difficult circumstances, we've got to look back and reflect on them. We've got to look outside of our prison walls and reflect on what God is doing all around us. And then here's the best part. Here's the message that Jesus gave to John's friends, and it's the same message that he gives to each one of us now. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble away, fall away, lose faith, give up. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. Blessed means blessed by God. God's paying attention. He knows your name. He knows your circumstances. And there is a promise at the end of your faithfulness. If you will remain faithful in spite of what Jesus hasn't done for you lately, in spite of what God hasn't done for you lately, in spite of the fact that nothing is changing for you, it's as if God looked through the portals of time and he said, I see your frustration. I see your hopelessness. I see that you are just on the verge of walking away. I see that you're on the verge of giving up. Don't give up. Don't give up on me. Blessed are you when you remain faithful. You refuse to walk away. You refuse to stumble on account of me.